This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Nile Rodgers was a founding member of the band Chic. If you don't know Chic by name, you certainly know this. Have you heard about the new band's craze? Listen to us. I'm sure you'll be amazed. Big fun to be had by everyone. It's up to you. Surely it can be done. Or maybe this. After Chic, Rodgers became one of the most successful pop music producers of all time. He worked with Madonna, David Bowie, the B-52s, Duran Duran, Grace Jones, a huge, expansive list of artists. But the music had one thing in common. It was for everyone, and you could dance to it. When I talked to Nile Rodgers, it was way back in 2011. In fact, it was so long ago that I was still recording the show at my house. So he was in the third floor master bedroom. I mean, it was the office of my house on Mount Washington Drive in Mount Washington. He came in and was just a double-barreled shotgun of pleasantness and charm from the moment he crossed my threshold. And this was before, 2 years before, Rodgers, after 40 years of making music, helped cut another immortal single with Daft Punk. We're up all night to get lucky. 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 These days, Rodgers is still touring, still producing, too. I just put out a record with Pitbull. This is Freak 54, Freak Out. I'm calling all my freaks. Mr. Worldwide. I'm calling all my freaks. This for the freaking ladies. So in the first couple of chapters of your new book, which is called Le Freak, it was sort of a continuing series of revelations of just outrageous family situations.
Yeah.
So let's start. You were born in the very beginning of the 1950s in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about your mother, your father, and the man who had the most father-ish role in your life, your stepfather.
Yes, my mom was really cool girl. She was actually born in Jersey, but by the time I was born, she had moved to New York City. My biological father is Nile Rodgers Sr. He was a percussionist who was sort of popular at the time. He played with a guy named Paul Whiteman, who was known as the King of Jazz.
And tell me about your stepfather, Bobby.
My mom married Bobby, I think, like in the early 60s, or maybe even the late 50s. And Bobby was Jewish, incredibly handsome, maybe one of the coolest guys I've ever known.
If you called your mother and stepfather by their first names, and if you had told me that and you were born in, you know, I was born in 1981 or even 1966 and you were 7 years old in 1973 or something like that, I don't think that would be that surprising. But I imagine that in the late 1950s, early 1960s, a black lady and a Jewish guy,
right,
married and living together with a few different kids by different people, calling them by their first names in a semi-open marriage,
right,
was pretty crazy.
I would say it was a very open marriage. Wasn't anything semi about it.
Were you aware of the way that you were culturally different from your peers? That you had these hipster and later to a growing extent junkie parents, and they were, you know, they had their artsy friends over. All I can imagine, you don't describe it too specifically, but I just imagine a lot of people in black turtlenecks snapping instead of clapping.
Absolutely. It was almost a caricature of the beatnik scene. I remember when this television show called Dobie Gillis came on and they had this character, Maynard G. Krebs. I was like, that's my man. I know Maynard. You know, it didn't seem weird to me. Actually, other people's families seemed weird because everybody in my immediate circle, they were like my parents. So everybody talked that hipster talk. Everybody was like, hey, you know, the super slow junkie thing. Hey, Nile, what's up? No one ever called me Nile. I was Pud. But, you know, hey, Pud, what's happening? And I was a kid, so it was normal. It was completely normal. And the amount of gay people, the amount of, I mean, it was a colorful crowd.
The other thing about your childhood, as you describe it in your book, is that you were in 1,000 different places and also nowhere. I mean, you were living with your two grandmothers. You had, you know, it just feels like I don't hear from you telling your story any time where you could be like, this is the place where I am me and not where I have to have my dukes up.
Well, that's almost true. When the hippie movement became really popular, that was the first time I felt really, really comfortable. From a very early age, I developed insomnia really young, and I'd stay up all night, much to the discomfort of the adults in my world, because I'd have the light on or the television on or something like that, and they'd get pissed off. So I started to run away and sleep on the train and then sneak back in the house before they'd wake up in the morning. So one day when I was a lot older, I was about 15 or 16, I had just moved back to New York from Los Angeles, and I snuck out to sleep on the subway, and I ran into a hippie. And this guy sort of took me under his wing, and from that moment on, I never really slept at home again, at least not for any lengthy period of time. But that night that I met this guy, we went and we slept in a crash pad, and it was a room filled with bodies, everybody lying on the floor on mattresses and wall-to-wall mattresses, and we smoked from a big hookah, and it was that communal life that made me feel comfortable because I always felt like someone had my back.
The last time I visited my aunt in Washington, D.C., who's probably just about your age, she told me about going to Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
And she's African-American. And she was just in her closet, and she pulled out this huge peace sign that she had in the back of her car. And she's like, oh, I put this in the back of my car for when I drove to Woodstock. And her memory of Woodstock
was... That means
was,
she's a little older than me. She had a driver's license.
Okay, fair enough. So she, and but not much, because she's the kind of lady was doing that stuff at 16. So she said to me, her recollection of Woodstock was this: that she got there, she looked around and saw all the white people and thought, "Oh, I'm the only person here to see Sly."
Right.
And I wonder if you had any self-consciousness about race being in a hippie world that was very, you know, it was partly about eliminating race as a category, but it was also very racialized.
Yeah, it was very real. I was lucky because I lived in a certain part of New York. I lived in Greenwich Village, and even when I moved to the Bronx, all of my friends were sort of, they were black hippies, they were white hippies, Puerto Ricans. We were from this really eclectic, unusual mix of people. My best friends were deadheads. All the deadheads I knew were black. Some of the musicians that I played with Leopold Stokowski's sons, the genius head of the American Symphony Orchestra. So we were a very cool group. It wasn't the racism that we used to feel mainly came from the outside world. In the hippie culture, I came along during the time of the White Panthers, John Sinclair, the MC5, David Peel and the Lower East Side, the Stooges. So I come from a background where a lot of the musicians, whatever racism and racial problems that you had in society, that would go away in the context of a band.
More still to come with Nile Rodgers. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can. Like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at MassMutual.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, we are listening back to my 2011 conversation with the great Nile Rodgers. He fronted the band Chic in the 1970s and went on to produce some of the biggest hit records of all time, like this one. Let's get into the rest of our conversation. You were playing with a sort of traditional R&B group touring the country, and that group who had had a big hit and had opened for the Jackson 5 didn't end up having a lot of other chart success, and you were playing with other groups on and off, and this sort of ran from the early 70s into the mid-70s, when disco started to happen for real. I wonder if you could describe to me, just aesthetically, what the difference was between the disco records that started to percolate in the mid-70s and the R&B records of just a couple of years earlier.
Basically, what had happened, there was a sort of political, spiritual, and musical convergence of all of these disparate, seemingly unconnected vibes. And what happened was disco was the sort of party that said, come on in, everybody's invited, you know, the water's fine. And I noticed that the jazz guys that I used to follow religiously were all of a sudden starting to get hit records that were on the same charts as the R&B artists. And then every now and then they would cross over to the pop and rock artists. And it wasn't really called disco at the time. It would later be called disco, but it at the beginning it was just sort of R&B. It was groove, it was funk, it was dance music, it was some other thing, but it had this shared DNA of jazz and R&B, but it was very open. And when I heard that happening and I saw it on the charts, the time had finally come where I knew where I belonged, where I had a place that I could do my jazzy, classical, wacky stuff and also write commercial hooks. And the very first song I composed for that style was a song by my band Chic called Everybody Dance. And with these really hip chord changes, but I superimposed this a ridiculously simple melody. And I wrote, everybody dance, do-do-do-do, clap your hands, clap your hands. And I remember I played that for Bernard Edwards the first time, and it was all complicated with these hip jazz chord changes. And he said to me, my man, you know, it's happening, but what the f*** does do-do-do-do mean? And I said, well, you know, it's the same thing as la-la-la-la. He said, well, why don't you say that? And I said, because do-do-do-do is hipper. I said, if you listen to all these, like, these records, you always hear him go, do-do-do-do-do-do. No one's going la 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 la. It was like the difference between hip and being, you know, like a Boy Scout around a campfire. So I stuck that in Everybody Dance, and Chic was off and running.
I was listening to that song. I hadn't listened to it in a while. And the thing that struck me was just the absurd complexity of the bass line of that song.
It's ridiculous.
Because, I mean, it is like a lot of dance records from that period. The bass is a really important part of the melody of that song. But it is just going all over everywhere. I mean, it is. There's 1,000 different things happening.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting to me that one of the things that typified those Chic records were... was the confluence of the simplest of simple, that they were driven by the classic disco beat, I mean, with a lot of other stuff going on around it on the drums as well, but mm-hmm. The central thing is that classic disco beat. They're driven by lyrics like, I mean, they're all called dance something.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like every song's
Everybody
lyrics
dance,
is like,
dance,
we're all dancing
dance.
Together, I'm enjoying dancing, like, hey, isn't dancing great? But then there are also these other things that are going on that are like laughably complicated for a pop record.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's what we call, in Chic, that's what we used to call DHM, the deep hidden meaning. I, as a writer, am the most complicated person in the world. Maybe even as a person, I'm ridiculous. And that's because everything that I do is governed by these invisible voices in my head of my old music teachers, what I call the jazz and classical police. Excuse me now, during the recapitulation, were you, you know, it's like, okay, well, the counterpoint, like, okay, guys. So that's the voices I always hear. Every time I write a song, it's so complicated, it's ridiculous. And Bernard used to be the great divining rod to find the water that would save our lives, because I was like, you know, this stuff is too complicated. And many times he would say to me, you know, brother, you got 5 or 6 songs in here. And he was right. We'd wind up writing 5 or 6 songs from an original idea that I would have.
You also helped create another central distinguishing element of disco as a sound, which is
that breakdowns and breaks,
right?
Which, you know, I mean, obviously your song Good Times became the first, was transformed into the first huge hip hop record, were a central part of what you were doing, which was something that you could do because you could make a lot, you could put a lot more music on a 12-inch record than you could on a 45.
Correct.
And so you had room to have something very complicated, break it all the way down to the simplest, sometimes even just a drum pattern.
That's right.
And then build it back up.
The concept with Chic was we believed our parts were clever. We were a part-playing band. And we always wanted to show it off. You know what I mean? So our basic philosophy was, you know, a song is just an excuse to go to a chorus, and a chorus is just an excuse to go to the breakdown. And that's really what we believed in. We just couldn't wait to get to the breakdown. And that was our thing. We wanted to show people how the song was constructed. And basically what we would do is we'd take it apart and then we'd rebuild it in the listener's ears so you could hear all those little parts come in. Because typically when you hear the full groove, you actually don't really know what we're playing. When I hear cover bands play Chic songs, I'm laughing. I go, that's what you think we're playing? They don't get the subtleties. They don't understand the upbeats going against the down and still sounding like it's all in the pocket because we have a four on the floor bass drum. So we were always proud of what we did, and we wanted to show people how hip it was. And we also knew that breakdowns work live.
Things were changing in pop music as the idea of a dance club where DJs played records became central to people's experience of pop music relative to, say, hearing a song on the radio or going to see a band. And part of what that allowed was something that I think was central to what Chic was, which is it allowed for a band to exist as much as a concept or a sort of set of aesthetic values, you know, visual and musical and the whole nine yards, as a group of people. So Chic were largely invisible. I mean, your shows were essentially an effort to create a live version of the album covers that didn't feature any of you.
Right.
And that's a really interesting idea to me, that you could start a band that almost removes the people from the equation.
Right. You're really, I love talking to you. You're great, man. This is, I'm not going to get any sleep today. You got it spot on. What happened was the etiology of that concept was I went to a show in London to see Roxy Music. And the Roxy Music was playing at this joint called the Roxy Theater or the Roxy Hall or something. And when I got in there, I had never heard of Roxy Music prior to this. The girl I was dating took me there to see these guys. And when I got inside, I had seen something that was sort of familiar, like what I had seen at the Apollo, you know, because everybody came in with their shtick and their costumes and the whole bit. But once they got off stage, then somebody else came on. But Roxy Music, they presented what I started to call a total immersive artistic experience. Like when you walked inside, it was like going into a museum. You know, when you go into a museum, regardless of what's going on outside those doors, you're in that space. And if it's the Tutankhamun exhibit, you're all wrapped in Egyptology or what have you. When you went to see Roxy Music in the Roxy Theater, it was amazing. The audience seemed like part of the vibe. This textural music, it was almost spiritual, I have to say. And then when we put our Chic Sophisto funk band together because we sort of designed it. We had an outline. We had a thumbnail concept of what it would be, and we started to fit the pieces into the puzzle. I describe it was sort of like the Magnificent Seven. You go out and you're looking for gunslingers, and we found Tony Thompson first, who had just come from LaBelle, so he was into the fantasy fusion thing. So that was cool. Then we found Rob Sabino, and Rob Sabino is the real sort of undersung hero in Chic, because Rob Sabino turned us on to his buddy Ace Frehley's band, which was Kiss. And when we went to see Kiss, pow, all of a sudden it was clear as a bell. These guys were on stage. It was almost like a carnival where they come to town, you get immersed in the world of Kiss, and they pack up and go to the next town. And I just looked at Bernard and said, this is it. We have to do this. And Bernard agreed, because Bernard knew that I didn't look like him or act, I didn't act like him, and he certainly didn't look like me or act like me, but we could create this thing where we both could come together and be those guys. We were role-playing, and we could both put on suits. We could pretend that we were Cab Calloway or something like that, but the modern version of Cab Calloway, a modern version of Count Basie. You know, Count Basie was the band leader. He sat there on the piano, but it was all the soloists and all those guys in his band that were the stars. He was the arranger. That's what Nile Rodgers was. Nile Rodgers was the songwriter, arranger. Bernard Edwards was the guy who was the band leader. And that's how our partnership worked so great. And at that point, you know, if you look at the time period, you have this all-inclusive music, this all-inclusive scene. Didn't make any difference whether you were white, black, fat, gay, lesbian, whatever. If you had music that kept people on the dance floor, you ruled. We never had to explain it to the musicians. Like, we never had to tell, you know, other musicians what Chic was about and what our concept was about. And they never really called us a disco band in the same way that you would call Cerrone disco. Cerrone is clearly disco. The Village People are clearly disco. We were this other funk dance thing, which now I will call disco because everybody keeps doing it, so forget it. You can't beat them, join them. One guy told me that our music was what they called black disco. I went, oh, guys, come on already.
I want to ask you about that part of it, because disco at its height in, you know, 1978, 1979 was getting it from two sides. One side was this return to rock and roll that spawned Disco Sucks, the Disco Sucks movie.
Right.
That was, I think we can say now, 30 years later, informed, you know, partly by people's aesthetic preferences, but also partly by a combination of racism and homophobia.
Yeah.
People who did not like the idea of a world where everybody came in together.
That's
in that
right.
way that you
and
described.
And that Sylvester could outsell the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, but the the other way that disco was getting it was from people who saw themselves as defenders of blackness, who did not like the way disco essentially deracinated, took the race out of dance music. So, you know, like Funkadelic had a character named the Anti-Disco Kid.
Right.
And so There are these two forces pushing against disco. And I wonder, I mean, I think that we hear a lot about the one where, you know, meathead rock and rollers are burning disco
right.
records. But as a guy who thought of himself partly as being in a funk band, how did you feel about that pressure coming from the other side, that you had come from this musical movement in 1973 where, you know, blackness was central?
Right.
To black popular music in 1970.
Right.
Could not have been more, you know.
Right.
I'm black and I'm proud.
That's right.
But then 5 years later, part of what disco was about was eliminating race from the conversation.
Right. But you're absolutely right. So there's two great examples for me. At the same time there was Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, Curtis Mayfield wrote, If There's a Hell Below, We're All Gonna Go. And it was from this, it's the same era. We did a show in San Diego one year where we were opening for Marvin Gaye. And Marvin had never heard of us, really. And anyway, we played. We got a huge standing ovation. Years later, when I thought that Marvin Gaye hated us because the San Diego show was unbelievable. If you look at any of the Chic tour books and they ask the members of Chic, what's the most memorable show? It's San Diego, California. So years later, somebody asked Marvin Gaye how he felt about disco and did he like any disco music? And he says, well, you know, there is one band I like. One band, Marvin Gaye. And I'm like going, what band is that? And he says, Chic. And he says, yeah, Chic, they really do some interesting stuff with. I mean, you can find the interview. It's on record. I couldn't believe it. I just found this out when I was doing this book. And I thought, wow. You know, because Marvin Gaye would have been in the other side that was anti the four and the floor, the anti, not as an artist, he wouldn't be anti-Sylvester. I mean, believe me. Anybody like Marvin, anybody like Sylvester, you had to have respect for him. Because, you know, the artists that were those, the early sort of disco pioneers that were obviously gay and blah, blah, blah. I mean, have you ever listened to the Village People's first album? I think it's sheer genius. And I also think that it's that kind of record that was so brilliant and so popular that it does put people on edge. They don't want to believe that gay people can come up with something that's that incredible, that that so holistically defines where they're coming from and do it in such an artistic way that the deep hidden meaning of that project almost becomes irrelevant. Like, you know, when you think about the New York Yankees adopting YMCA, and they have umpires who are basically guys who go D's, dim, and do's on the field going, YMCA.
I mean, one of the things that's, I think, so powerful about it is that it is something, those most powerful moments in disco are, a lot of them are super, super gay. Culturally, right. Come from right. Yeah. Just super gayness.
Yeah.
And they are uniting people who, especially in 1979, but even today, are very uncomfortable.
That's right.
With that word.
I mean, when you think about it, when we wrote We Are Family for Sister Sledge, we honestly were just writing an R&B breakdown dance record for a group of sisters that we had never met, but we saw these girls as a cutting-edge family like the Jackson 5. So it was sincere. We were trying to define these girls that were on the cutting edge, defining that lifestyle. And of course, we know that when it comes to fashion, there are a lot of gay voices in fashion. When it comes to that sort of cutting edge visual arts coming together, there's a gay undercurrent, if not a frontal gay thing. And my favorite thing in life was to watch the Pittsburgh Pirates sing I Got All My Sisters With Me. Bernard and I used to laugh our off. It was hysterical. We used to say, look at these big, burly men who are probably some of the most macho dudes in America, especially
Willie
in those
Stargell,
days.
Right? Like 6'5", 250.
Right, yeah, like a million pounds. Looks like a sumo wrestler. And they're all going, we are family. I got all my sisters with me. And Nard and I used to crack up because if you went to a gay club and played that, you'd see people who were flamboyant singing the same song with the same zeal. And that's what we really believed in. And that's what the disco movement gave everybody.
We'll finish up with Nile Rodgers after a quick break. Stick around. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Noom. Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Check out The Noom Kitchen for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Folks, we get it. Keeping up with an actual play podcast in this economy is a tough sell. That's why we have great news for you. The Adventure Zone is changing up its format. We're going to be doing some shorter seasons, more experimental stuff. There's never been a better time to get on board the Zone.
And if you're sick of listening to our voices, we get that too. So we're including some guests on this upcoming one. We've got Kate Welch and Gabe Hicks, who are incredible.
And you want us to try out some new games? You got it. We've got the new Marvel Multiverse RPG. We're using that and with a really brilliant GM doing it.
It's Dad. What he's saying is it's Dad. Dad doing it.
You can listen every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Nile Rodgers, guitarist and legendary record producer.
In 1983, you produced David Bowie's best-selling record, and it had this amazing single on it called Let's Dance, and I want to hear a little bit of this. There's something really interesting to me about this song, because it came for you after disco had gone from everything to nothing in the space of, I don't know, 2 years maybe. And your power as ultimate hitmaker with your partner Bernard Edwards had gone from, you know, just solid platinum, everything you touched, to not working anymore because people hate disco. And there's something really amazing about this song, which is that I think that there is a really interesting contrast that a lot of, that became pop music, that became what you produced for Madonna and so on and so forth, that was more than just a white person doing black people music, I think. There's this element in this David Bowie song of the coolness of Bowie, the reserve, the rock star, a slightly off-center angularity of Bowie, as a contrast with, you know, like what sounds in some ways like a dance record, in some ways like, you know, like it's Twist and Shout or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was a new thing. And I see somewhere in here you mentioned Bowie describing it as like a postmodern reconstruction of dance music. Yeah. That is what it sounds like because of that. I mean, not dissonance. It's a combination of dissonance and consonance, of that coolness, that pulling back and that pushing forward that comes from dance music.
The interesting thing about the Let's Dance project was when David and I started working on that project, before one note of music was determined to be on that record, all we did was research. And when David was studying himself, I was studying David. He was showing me what the past was, because we could only show the past, right? That's what everything that we could listen to and watch was something that was documented. And we were taking these documents to use as the blueprint to go into the future, to this new place. And it was really interesting how the first night David and I met, all we did was talk about jazz, from the most avant-garde to almost the most straight-ahead and commercial. So I knew that David loved jazz, and I knew that the jazzy elements that I could put in Let's Dance, and even on other tracks on that album, but certainly Let's Dance. I've never made a record that's been a pop record that's that avant-garde, with that little pocket trumpet solo at the beginning. I mean, you know, come on. But only Bowie and guys like that can get away with it. And because I was really in the zone when I did that record, David even instructed me to make hits. I mean, literally, he said, "Nile, I want you to do what you do best." And I was offended. So what do you mean? I was an artist. You don't know what I do best. The world doesn't know what I do best. I've never been unleashed on the world with my genius. I was like, no, you make hits. Oh, really? And in my case, I usually get called when an artist is not doing well. So it's always been doubly hard for me, and I don't get to just, you know, write and produce the great single. I have to do the whole album to come up with that great single. So it's a tricky thing. Let's Dance showed me that I could do what I was doing with black artists. I can now do that with white artists, because with white artists, it wouldn't be called disco. All of a sudden, it was dance. It was new wave. It was modern rock. It was all of these other new gentrified titles, which basically meant the same thing, because I was never doing, I never did, at least I never thought I did anybody's last record. I always thought I was doing someone's first, the next record. So Bowie said to me something really fantastic when we were doing Let's Dance. He says that he's never been placed in a box. He's never felt that to make music, he has to do what people expect him to do, or even what people think he should do. He says he always does whatever it is that makes him feel good, basically. I'm paraphrasing him poorly, but that's what he was saying. And that gave me a lot of strength when we did Let's Dance, because it made me believe that, wow, I could work with this guy who I call the Picasso of rock and roll and make pop songs, but they'd be uniquely his. Nothing sounds like Let's Dance in my repertoire. It's the only thing that sounds like that, and that's because it was for Bowie. Nothing sounds like I'm Coming Out because it was for Diana Ross. Nothing sounds like We Are Family because it was for Sister Sledge.
I want to ask you one last thing, which is that you, about a year ago, you had major cancer surgery.
Yes.
And you had by then already spent years looking at your life in order to write this book, interviewing family members and all the people that you knew and that kind of thing, as well as just spending time with your recollections. And you had had this life that at times, you know, at the height of your addictions was just insanely wild and flirted with death every day, but you never yourself had run into that wall. But I wonder how having that experience of mortality changed both how you looked at your life in the past and how you looked at how you wanted to use the life that you have in the future.
Well, that's like the greatest question. The life that I want in the future, actually, I wrote about it today on the airplane flying in to Los Angeles, that and I say this with 100% sincerity, that the life that I want for myself now is, however the Grim Reaper, whenever the Grim Reaper decides to claim me and keep me for good, I just want to be able to play songs when I'm doing it. If I lose the ability to play music, I'll probably be, I don't mean to be so fatalistic and end the interview on such a wacky note, but I'm really as good as dead then. I live for music. It's probably unfortunate that I'm so, that myopic, but I don't really mean that. I have a lot of interests, but I could live without those other interests. I cannot live without music. I can't live without being able to play music. Now, what does that mean? I don't have to be a star. I don't have to make hit records anymore. I just have to be able to pick up the guitar and practice.
Nile Rodgers, recorded at my house in 2011. What a legend. He is now in his 70s, still touring, still working, still producing. He's still got it. We'll have a link to his website on the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. I've got a shed in my backyard that needs flooring. What do you think about linoleum? Show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. I'm going to check in with him about linoleum as soon as I leave the studio. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. By the way, we are hiring a new production fellow at Maximum Fun. So if you are a Bullseye listener or a public radio fan or a podcast person and you would like to have a one-year paid fellowship making radio and podcasts here at Maximum Fun in L.A., just go to MaximumFun.org/jobs. And if you know somebody, MaximumFun.org/jobs. It's a great gig. Work directly with the Bullseye team, among other things, here at Max Fun. It's a lot of fun. We get booking help from Merritt Davis. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is Huddle Formation. It was written and recorded by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team. Thanks to Memphis Industries, their label. Bullseye is on Instagram. There are interview highlights there, behind-the-scenes looks, all kinds of stuff, at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from Jackson. Let's face it, retirement planning can be confusing. At Jackson, we're working to make retirement clear for everyone, starting with you. Our easy-to-understand resources and user-friendly digital tools help simplify your entire experience. You can have confidence in your retirement with clarity from Jackson. Seek the clarity you deserve at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial Incorporated, Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Leesa.com to learn more. That's Leesa.com.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.